Hey everyone, and welcome back to Scorncast, the official podcast of the Pop Scorn Movie Blog, which can be found at scornpop.blogspot.com. This is Jasper, I hate emoticons, and joining me because of the court order is Ghostface Milla, a writer at the Roundtable Music Blog. You can read him and download his weekly mixes at www.theroundtableonline.com. On this episode, we'll be digging into Super 8, the super secretive small town mystery from director J.J. Abrams, in which a group of kids in 1979 Ohio sneak out at night to shoot a homemade zombie movie, and end up making an otherworldly discovery that'll change their lives forever. I wish that was my childhood. Roll that trailer.
Be good for you to spend some time with kids who don't run around with cameras and monster makeup.
We're filming tonight, midnight, okay? Don't forget.
I won't. Over.
And action!
Guys, watch out!
Do not speak of this. If you do, they will find you.
I've got 9 people missing now. But there are things happening around here that I can't explain.
I don't feel good about this.
I saw it. No one believes me.
I believe you.
So, Ghostface, before we get to unpacking Super 8, and I really can't wait to unpack the shit out of this movie, I wanted to comment on the marketing campaign, which began with a pretty mysterious teaser trailer attached to Iron Man 2 last summer, and then this teaser was sort of expanded into a longer trailer that elaborated more on the movie's setting and characters and setup while still remaining pretty mysterious. And basically, there's been a lot of murmur from the internet community in the past few weeks leading up to Super 8's release, and you know how the internet community is, about how shrouded in secrecy this movie is. And as far as the big picture goes, I'm going to take the counterpoint and say that in terms of story beats, there's not a whole lot of this movie that the trailer doesn't give away or at least allude to. And even at its most secretive, I'd say the trailer is sort of like a fill-in-the-blanks puzzle where the blanks are pretty easy to fill in yourself. Do you agree?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that. I totally agree. And, you know, I think, you know, people have said that the movie's not doing so well or that it's not going to do as well because of the marketing campaign behind it. And I think I understand what they're saying because, you know, the first teaser kind of came out and it seemed more action-y or more mysterious. Not a scandal, but, you know, kind of like an Area 51 kind of thing. Like, what is that? What's in there? What does this mean? And then it kind of turned into something else with the longer trailer. But, I mean, I knew there was going to be more to it because it was J.J. Abrams / Steven Spielberg project, right? So you know it's never really about what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that, you know, it was pretty easy to fill in. When I finally saw the movie, I wouldn't say I was disappointed by how straightforward it was laid out to us before, but I was kind of like, oh, like, this is really what it is. Like, they tell you a lot of this in the trailer. You know, there's really nothing you couldn't have gleaned from that that wasn't in there. But I still was with it, obviously. But yeah, I totally understand what you're saying.
We talked about this movie on our summer preview, and it was on both of our lists of summer movies that we were really excited about. And one of the things we discussed that I think everyone is discussing right now is how this movie is sort of like J.J. Abrams fronting a Steven Spielberg tribute band. Although that metaphor doesn't make any sense at all, actually, now that I think of it. But while watching the movie, particularly in the early passages, I more or less lost myself in this really high, pretty incredible nostalgia factor. And it actually wasn't until the plot wheels started spinning and this really crazy train crash sequence happens and it goes on for like 10 minutes that I was reminded that I was watching something that was released in 2011.
Yeah, totally. And that's what I love so much about it, too, is that, like, it was so innately from that time period. Like, it just felt so that. So, was it, like, 78, 79?
79, I think.
Yeah, 79. And so, I mean, everything about it felt like that. And I think that, you know, I've read some things of, like, oh, this is kind of like a snafu. They didn't have Rubik's Cubes yet, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, little tiny things that they reference, but I think overall it was totally on point just with the feeling of it. Not even totally the look and the details, but, like, the feeling, the way people spoke and kind of the pacing, the tone of it. and the way it was shot too. You know, I think it really did remind me of E.T. and even older movies too. You know, Close Encounters, just in the way that it was shot, which I think is like that's totally something that most audience goers probably wouldn't even recognize, but they would just get. You know, like it would just be a part of it, but they wouldn't necessarily call it out.
Yeah, and one of the things I liked about, especially the setting of this movie, is how it was 1979, but they didn't really overdo it. Like, they had Match Game on a television set playing in the background, and you saw a poster for Halloween on somebody's bedroom wall. But it wasn't, like, that 70s show.
Right. Yeah, I don't think they made any jokes about stuff that's going to happen in the future, you know, or anything. You know, it wasn't kind of a forward-looking. It was very nostalgic, everything about it, you know, not to say it, you know, kind of idolized or idealized this time period, but I think it, to a degree, it kind of paid homage to, you know, quote-unquote simpler time, kids stealing cars and, you know, going to film a movie at midnight, you know, like 12-year-olds or however old they are, you know, all that stuff. There was really no inherent danger, and you kind of get that feeling, too. That is, until this giant, never-ending train crash happens. But you know, the fact that they were kind of running around. I mean, even there's moments where they're running past, like, you know, they're on their bikes, and they're running past, like, bullets and things flying by and all this stuff. And even though you know it's an kind of action movie and that, like, there's, you know, bad things are going to happen, you kind of are like, but that's okay. Like, they're kids. It's like the late 70s. Like, everything's going to be fine. You know, I don't know if I can explain it better than that, but there was just kind of like such a nostalgic, you know, innocent children kind of feeling about it.
Yeah, I mean, given that it's from Steven Spielberg, who's made a lot of these movies in the 80s, in the 90s, you know that nothing bad is probably going to happen to these kids.
Yeah.
I loved these kids, by the way, as characters and as performers. And not only are they really natural actors, but they're written and acted age appropriately, which is sometimes the only thing you can ask of movies where kids are the main characters, right?
Yeah, and I think that was what was so cool about it, too, is that, like, they're kind of all shouting at each other, and, like, they all have, like, their little bits, you know, their little jokes, their recurring kind of characteristics, but they were just so believable, you know? Like, I felt like I definitely knew those kids and will continue to know kids just like them.
I'm a little alarmed about continuing to know kids like them, because I wonder if I wonder if kids now, like 12 and 13-year-olds now, are going to watch this movie and be like, who are these children?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I could totally understand what you're saying, but I think, I don't know, there was something about their rapport mm-hmm. that just felt so real. So even if maybe kids that are 12 or 13-year-olds would be like, they're babies, you know, like they're acting like little kids or something. I don't know. But I think that their interactions were so natural. Just, I mean, really just the shouting. And it was probably like 2/3 into the movie that I was like, there is a lot of shouting in this movie.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I love how true that is. I like that these kids aren't like overly precocious or cutified up, is cutified a word. But I love that the characters, who are this big group of best friends, they have these fairly childish, pretty loud clashes that are smoothed over without much circumstance. Because when you're a kid, before you grow up into an awful passive-aggressive teenager, that's how you do things, right?
Right, yeah, you kind of just get over it, you know, or whatever. You just keep going. And I think that it was more of just them being heard. Them actually fighting. You know, they're kind of just all so excited and all yelling at the same time. A lot of it wasn't even necessarily angry shouting, and that's kind of why it was, like, tolerable, you know, because some of them were happening in scenes where it wasn't that loud. You know, it's not like bombs were going off in the background, and they're kind of just all shouting. But it was more of just, like, they all wanted to talk at the same time. They all had things to say, which I think just speaks to, like, how comfortable they were with each other, you know, as far as, like, being friends, and also kind of how they spend too much time together, you know? Yeah, I loved it. I mean, can I just call out Elle Fanning, though? I mean, Elle Fanning is, I mean, one, because she was, like, the only female in the whole movie. The two, her performance was so good. That was so good. I totally cared for this character that, like, didn't really show us a lot about her. But, you know, I felt very similar to the protagonist, the main character. I forget his name, but just in how he cared for her and, like, you know, wanted to protect her and stuff like that. And obviously, she was a plot device in the end, but I think that there was, like, she brought more to it along the way.
Yeah, the main character is played by a kid, Joel Courtney. I don't think he's ever acted before. I also wanted to point out, when you were talking about how loud these kids are with each other, they throw the word shit around a lot, right?
Yeah.
And I love that, because that's an age when you think you're tough and grown up for saying shit a lot. But, like, right. Meanwhile, you're probably a little too leery of going straight for fuck.
Right, yeah. And also, I think sometimes the way that they incorporated shit into what they were saying just, like, proved how, like, not that used to saying it they were.
Yeah.
Which I loved, you know, because it totally felt real. Like, I feel like I, you know, my cousins, when they first started cussing all the time, were, like, saying the randomest phrases. And I was just like, well, you know, you barely know what you're saying. Like, just relax. But I think I got that in this movie, too. Just all of them, you know, kind of too big for their britches kind of thing. It was cool.
It reminded me a lot of The Goonies, and not, like, just in the overall story arc, which is sort of similar to The Goonies, but just in how I remember watching The Goonies when I was younger and being really, like, surprised that this cast of children was allowed to swear as much as they were.
Right.
And now you watch Super 8 in 2011 and you think, wow, they should probably be swearing more.
Right, yeah, I'm like, man, these kids are really good. Oh, right, it's the late 70s, like, thinking, like, people were different then.
Yeah.
But yeah, I feel the same way. And in a way, I think it was nice that this was probably, like, you know, in these kids' lives, like, this is probably, like, the year before they start to talk like that, you know, or something like that. This is probably, like, their last innocent summer, you know, that was technically not that innocent, seeing all the stuff that they saw. But I still think that, you know, that you're right. Like, it was kind of them just, like, cussing, not going all the way with it, but, like, you know, getting that in because they're almost there, you know.
And the performances across the board of this young cast are really all amazing. And I feel like in a lot of ways, there are some kind of clunky backstory issues and developments that these kids sort of make up for.
Right, yeah. I was just going to say, I think there's kind of a lack of humanity in, like, you know, just the general story of, like, the mother passing away, and then you kind of slowly start to find out, you know, how the other guy, Elle Fanning's character's father, was involved and all that stuff. Like, I wasn't that emotionally connected to that, but I think the kids adding the humor that they did and kind of progressing the story in the way that they did added that level of humanity that was kind of missing. You know, that you weren't going to get enough from the main character because it's kind of reserved. But I think that, you know, they kind of filled in that gap, which was nice.
Now, I'm eager, like I said earlier, I'm eager to unpack this. From here on out, I just kind of want to issue a spoiler warning because I want to talk about the last, I would say the last third of this movie in a lot of detail. Because this is where it all went wrong for me. I feel like this movie set up so much promise and then sort of half-assed the follow-through. And I wonder if that's the effect of the story with these kids and their relationships and the overview of this small town in Ohio, right? It's Ohio?
Yeah, I think so.
I was really into all of that stuff, and it's only when the movie starts to focus on the more summer movie elements that it really started to trip it up for me. I want to time travel back to 2008, and I want to talk about Cloverfield for a minute. When I saw Cloverfield, I saw it at a midnight screening, so it was like a crowd of people who were all really into, I guess, the way that movie was marketed and promoted and wanted to know all the secrets about it, you know, immediately up front before the movie opened, you know, in wide release the next day. And when I was walking out of that screening, some asshat in front of me was like, oh my god, that was so stupid. We never found out where the monster came from or what it wanted. And I think that's a pretty dubious criticism of that movie because that's not at all the story that movie was interested in telling. What I wanted to say to this guy was, can you imagine how ridiculous it would have been if those hipsters ran into a guy in a white lab coat in Battery Park who explained it all to them?
Yeah, yeah. Or if, like, God forbid, one of them was taken to, like, you know, they hopped in a spaceship, found, and went to their planet, and they were like, oh, human, here's our story,
yeah.
You know, or whatever.
Right. And I feel like that's kind of what Super 8 did.
You think?
Where this movie started to go wrong for me, I think the first warning sign that I had was kind of early on. I got a weird feeling about when the train crashes, and you find out it's this science teacher at their local high school who has sort of tried to derail the train with his pickup truck. And I thought, you know, this is obviously important. This guy's not probably going to be just like a drunk guy. Like, he sort of ominously warns them to run and forget what they've seen, right? Because people are going to come after them if they're caught at the scene of this train derailment, because something was in one of these train cars that slinks into the woods, which I find it funny. We've been talking about this movie for like 20 minutes and we haven't even brought up the thing that was in the train car.
Right, I know.
But that was like my first sign that, okay, this is a plot point. It's going to come back in the movie, and this is going to be a big part of the story. And it is, because later on in the movie, they figure out that this science teacher is a former government scientist, and they break into his classroom after their town has been evacuated by the military, who are quarantining the town because they're obviously aware that that there's something in the town running loose that turns out to be an alien. And they find in this classroom like an 8mm film or whatever of the science teacher when he was working for the government about the alien's behavior. They had it like locked up, and I feel like that's the kind of thing that the guy in front of me walking out of Cloverfield wanted from Cloverfield.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand where you're coming from, but I mean, I didn't mind it because I think that it was, you know, is in a way that I think these kids needed to understand. The scientist guy had died, and if he had done anything, he had properly warned them in a way that they knew not everything was what it seemed. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think for them to be interested in that, you know, he was kind of the one-eyed Willy that they were kind of going after, or like, the, you know, his knowledge, as opposed to gold. You know, I think that it made sense for me. I wasn't totally, you know, so gung-ho about the explanation. I was kind of like, huh, all right. And then, you know, when at the end of the day, it kind of turned into a very kind of let-down situation, you know, when they finally do confront the alien, you know, and they try to save Elle Fanning's character. You know, he has a heart-to-heart with it. And I thought, although the CG was done very well, you know, I was kind of just like, all right, let's just end this scene now. It was a little too much sentimentality for me, but I still think, you know, as far, it didn't stand out from the film as far as, like, this doesn't belong here. I felt it kind of needed it just so that, you know, we would care, because otherwise I'd be like, just kill the thing, you know, or whatever.
I'm glad you brought that up about just killing the thing, because that's point number two that I'm going to make. The first thing I want to say is that scene where they're watching this film, I agree with you in the sense that these kids needed to find out some information about this creature and what it was doing. I feel like there would have been a better way to explain it that didn't seem like it was talking down to the audience. Just because we get from the next couple passages that this is like a telepathic alien, and we understand just by seeing what these mysterious little white cubes are that are all through the movie, that are sort of spill out of the train crash, and the main character takes one of them with him, and we see what they are. Like, we don't really need the explanation in terms of that videotape to be told all this stuff. I feel like we get it pretty much. It's like one of those things where the movie tells you before it shows you, which I guess is better than just telling you and not showing you, but still, it's a little clunky. But getting to what you were talking about, the monster. So in the end of the movie, Elle Fanning is kidnapped by the monster, and they have to go into the town, and after it's been evacuated, and try to figure out where its creature lair is, and they find it, and they go inside. And I just really was rolling my eyes out of my head. Because, just to use a Spielbergian metaphor, I feel like J.J. Abrams really wants to pitch you this creature reverently. It's kind of almost like if J.J. Abrams was making Jaws, he went all E.T. or Close Encounters in the final reel. Like, it's sort of like at the end of Jaws, if Roy Scheider took a long look at the shark and was like, he's just really hungry, okay?
Right, yeah, exactly, yeah. He was like, he's just like you and me, you know?
Like, yeah, like, suddenly we're supposed to have empathy for this creature that we just saw eat an innocent person, and who knows who else before that. Right. So, for me, I was really sort of annoyed by how the creature goes after these kids, and it picks up Joel Courtney and has this telepathic connection with him, in which Joel Courtney realizes, you know, he just wants to go home. He just wants to go home. My point being, these kids just saw it eat somebody from their town. Who knows who else it ate? And they do end up rescuing Elle Fanning, of course. But at the same time, I'm going like, okay, what if Joel Courtney and his friend saw the monster eat Elle Fanning? Would they really be like that, like reverent towards the creature all of a sudden?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I totally got that. And I the way that they didn't even really show him eating anyone. And that was kind of like, I think they needed to do that because, and now that you're saying it, I remember it, but I kind of forgot as I was watching it. Like, and they, you know, they see it, and they're like, oh my god, he's eating them! You know, or like, yeah, whatever, but I was kind of like, oh, what else is he gonna do? You know, he's an alien. But yeah, and then he finally was just kind of like, oh, he's just like us, right? He just wants to go home, or whatever. And that scene, that little shot, kind of went on for too long. And even though, like, I think the cool part about it, I think the only cool part about it was that, like, kind of you could see the change in his eyes, like, in the alien's eyes,
mm-hmm.
Just in the way that it was made. So he kind of went from, like, being a Cloverfield monster to being an E.T., just in the softness and in the way that his eyes kind of changed. And that was neat, you know, that was a good shot. But I think kind of how everything that surrounded it was handled, I don't know, it was a little too, you know, just forget about all the bad things he's done. Like, he's fine, you know. I think, you know, in the end of the day, this is one of those things where, like, the military is the number one aggressor, right? And so, and they proved that with having that one military guy who never listened to the scientists, and, like, the whole sequence in the bus, you know, and stuff like that, of just, like, how angry the military is, and how, you know, they're so bad, and how they take over that one house, you know, and all those things. So I felt like as the audience, like, we were kind of always supposed to be on the alien side, even though it freaked us out. You know, it's made very clear that the alien was only doing what he felt that he had to do.
But at a certain point in the movie, once the military guys are all eaten, there's still about, like, what, 25 minutes of the movie left? I was just sort of really weirded out by the whole thing. And I'm not sure how much of the movie then in retrospect holds up because of this reveal. And I kind of had hoped that it would turn out that there were, like, two aliens in the town. Like, one was, like, the muscle and one was the brain or something. Just because you have this gigantic creature running around and, like, grabbing people and eating them. And I'm no expert in imaginary creature physiology. But I wonder, like, if this alien seemed capable of doing a lot of the stuff that it presumably does throughout the movie. There's a scene where some old lady who works in a department store sees Kyle Chandler, who plays the deputy of the town, and he's Joel Courtney's father. And she says to him, you know, somebody stole all my microwaves. And what really stuck out for me in retrospect is that she wasn't like, somebody stole all my microwaves. Also, there's a giant monster-sized hole where the store entrance used to be.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and I thought that was kind of in later, you know, I was kind of like, no one else said anything about the hole in the ground. So it was kind of like really convenient that, I don't know, maybe the alien made holes farther away from his target, you know, so like he would run and hit up a store and then carry 90 microwaves down this hole. I don't know. But yeah, that was kind of like just lazy.
And this alien, of course, has taken all these microwaves and installed them under the water tower in the center of the town to sort of make this, like, giant electromagnet, or something like a giant electromagnet, that pulls all of the cube things that spilled out when the train crashed, so he can pull all these things together and, I guess, refashion his spaceship. But I wondered, like, then again, like, not only does this thing not seem capable of, like, letting himself into a department store to steal a bunch of microwaves, but, like, does he seem capable of reworking all of these electronic devices to make a giant electromagnet?
Yeah, I just figured he was super smart. I mean, maybe he'd been working on these plans for 50 years. I don't know.
Maybe we'll get a prequel to Super 8. We'll get, yeah, Super 7 one day, and it'll explain everything. And one thing that I thought was really weird, and I this is a question I have for you, because it's a story point that I didn't really get. When the kids do get into the town and they're trying to find where this monster's lair is, there are shots where the tanks driven by these army guys are kind of going apeshit around the town, and they're just, like, rolling over everything. They're rolling over playgrounds, going up the streets, and they're firing automatically. And you see a close-up of a soldier on a walkie-talkie, and he says something to the effect of that the electromagnetic pulse or whatever that's being emitted from the center of the town is causing the tanks to just kind of go crazy, right?
Right.
Okay, so now I have another question, because in some of these scenes, you see the tanks running up the street, followed by these soldiers who are holding guns that they're shooting. Now, I'm presuming that the tanks are just kind of like running by themselves because of whatever force this creature is putting out. But like, why on earth are the soldiers running up the streets with guns?
Yeah, I didn't know if like they made it seem like all guns were going crazy, and I was like, okay, that's weird that like all guns are going crazy, but also just don't hold a gun. Put your gun in a room and shut the door and run away.
Yeah, I wanted a shot of like all these soldiers throwing their guns like in a big pile and then running crazily away from it. And
yeah, I was never sure why that happened.
And the shot of the soldier on the walkie-talkie, I'm curious to see this movie again, if only to really study that shot, because the first time you see it, before the soldier even speaks and gives you this relevant plot information, I thought to myself, this shot looks green-screened. This looks like something that was shot, like, just a couple months ago, as a way to clarify.
Really?
Yeah, it would not surprise me if I found out somehow that they test-screened it or whatever, or J.J. Abrams was editing the movie and decided that plot point needed to be, you know, elaborated on, because that one shot did not look like it was part of the movie to me.
Right, yeah. I mean, I wonder if there was, like, an alternate version of, like, you know, the plot where they were like, oh, he's hiding in the houses, blow up every house. And then they were like, wait, people aren't going to believe this. Let's tell them there's an electromagnet that's making guns fire.
Yeah, people will believe that.
Right, yeah. It's science speak. They'll believe anything.
And just like a lot of people sort of criticized the Steven Spielberg movie from about 10 years ago, AI, artificial intelligence. A lot of people sort of said that, you know, this was Stanley Kubrick's pet project for the longest time that he never really realized or got around to doing. So Spielberg picked it up and did his own take on it. And that movie got criticized for, I think, giving you a lot upfront of Kubrick. And then finally, like the last 20 minutes or so, more Spielberg than Kubrick. And I wonder if this movie is like a lot of J.J. Abrams, and then in the final reel, more Spielberg. Because there's that final sequence where, we've issued enough spoiler alerts, so. But there's a final sequence where they're all watching the alien spaceship reform in the middle of the town, and they're all looking up at it in complete awe. And there's this really, really goofy moment where Joel Courtney has carried this locket, inside of which is a picture of him and his mother. His mother has died. And this electromagnetic pole that the alien spaceship is emanating pulls the locket, like, up in the air. And Joel Courtney is, like, holding on to it and fighting it. He won't let it go. And finally, then he opens his palm and lets this locket go towards. And it becomes part of the spaceship or whatever. I feel like you can let go of your past by not literally letting go of your past.
But how will the audience know you've let go?
Oh, God, that kills me. That absolutely kills me.
So I'm not going to lie, I actually kind of loved that scene and that shot. And even though I knew exactly what was going to happen, and I thought it was so dumb that 20 minutes after everything else that was metal flew up there, you know, the alien was like, wait, I just need one more thing, you know, or whatever. Because literally, like, everything else had stopped moving. Like, we were done with the magnet. And then, like, there was some, like, reunion between, like, the families, you know, the deadbeat dad and Al Fanning and the cop dad and I thought that was, like, a nice moment, you know, and then it was going to end there. But I was like, wait a minute, what about that stupid locket that we've been seeing movie? That has to be up there. And I think it actually didn't join the ship, but what it did was he needed to puncture the water tower or something and then use that water. And that's kind of where it lost me. He needed to, like, use that water to propel him forward. Like, it was, like, I don't know, hydrogen-fueled or something. But I thought that was the thing, like, that was the straw that broke the camel, or the locket that broke the water tower, you know, like, it was kind of really dumb. But at the same time, I'm not going to lie, I probably teared up and was like, oh my God, it's Mom, you know. But I think they could have done it earlier. I think you're right, it was totally Spielberg, way too sentimental. But to be honest, I think I felt Spielberg in this movie throughout. There was a lot of, maybe not sequences, but there was a lot of things that just felt like his hand had been there, you know, and kind of okayed it or tweaked it.
Yeah, definitely. Now that I think about it, I feel like as soon as the locket got up there, there was an explosion, right?
Yeah.
Like the water tower exploded as soon as it made contact with the locket or whatever. See, if those kids had watched that video they found just for a few more minutes, they might have been able to understand what had happened in the end of the movie.
Right. If only the audience could have seen those extra few minutes.
Yes. So if you were giving Super 8 a grade, what grade would you give it?
I'd probably give it a B+.
I would go B, just simply for the fact that I absolutely loved the first two-thirds of this movie and did not absolutely love the last third of this movie. But if it had kept up, I really feel like if that last third was as strong as the first two-thirds, then this would be a lock for one of my favorite movies of the year.
Wow, yeah. No, I mean, I definitely loved it a lot, and I would say the only reason I'm not giving it an A is because it's overuse of the lens flare, which I know is J.J.'s thing,
yeah.
But I don't think it's appropriate in every movie he makes.
The train station sequence right before the crash, it was going crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think it added to it, but like throughout the movie, maybe not so necessary.
There wasn't any lens flare on the video that the kids watched of the sun.
I know, and that's why I hated that part.
So did J.J. Abrams. And that's going to wrap up another episode of Scorncast. Thanks to Ghostface Miller for stopping by. Thanks to Bug for our theme music. And just a reminder, you can visit PopScorn at scornpop.blogspot.com, and you can email PopScorn at scornpop@gmail.com. In the original ending of Super 8, the kids found out that the alien was kidnapping the townsfolk and stealing all those microwaves just because it was a hoarder. So maybe the ending that made it to the movie isn't so bad after all.